Super funky.
Welcome to a special bilingual version of Super Science Me. This is Ross Lipton, and I will be your co-host today. As we explore the world of infectious diseases and the stories they tell. While our topic this month is indeed huge, we're going to try to at least bite off a small piece and see what we can get from this cross-section of the beast that is contagion, as in communicable diseases and the stigmas and taboos that such epidemics create in their wake. Thank you. This spring, I traveled to Lee, a small town off the coast of New Hampshire, to interview William Haver in his cozy New England house, where he lives with his husband and his two devoted dogs, who you will hear occasionally throughout the interview. In the early months of 1981, several dozen gay men began suffering and eventually succumbing to a cadre of obscure diseases that left their doctors utterly baffled. Maladies such as Kaposi sarcoma, which are non-lethal skin lesions, pneumocystis carini pneumonia, a rare lung infection was discovered in 5 male patients in Los Angeles, all in their 20s. Other men began to lose their vision due to a rare disease known as CMV, otherwise known as cytomegalovirus. It took months for doctors in cities such as New York, San Francisco, and Los Angeles to realize that these mysterious illnesses derived from a single source, an immunosuppressant syndrome that flowed seamlessly from carrier to carrier. However, the mode of transference remained a mystery for the first year of the epidemic. It was not until 1982 when scientists began to realize that the virus was transmitted through contact with bodily fluids.
The way of thinking about pandemics and about contagion in general, I think has changed quite dramatically. I mean, this was written just as epidemiologists had come to the realization that this model of inheritance, of genealogy, you know, where they were trying to find patient zero and who fucked whom, and you had to submit a whole list of who you'd had sex with. They realized that that just didn't work. And that add that to the fact that the incubation period was up to 7 years before you became symptomatic or it even showed up in a blood test. You know, this sort of trying to draw lineages of Haitians and West Africans and gays and, you know, drug users and so on and so forth, that just doesn't work. So you have to think of it more in the same sense that you think of something like the flu virus. That to think of containment is very, very rarely effective.
The mystery surrounding these illnesses and deaths in the early 1980s created a stigma, a culture of fear that would continue to follow the disease, exacerbating its horrendous impact. Journalists, researchers, and doctors began to refer to the illness as GRID, or gay-related immune disease, otherwise referred to as gay cancer, in the first article published in the New York Times on the subject in the summer of 1981. This term, gay cancer, was also used in an article in the newspaper The New York Native, as well as in public speeches by early AIDS activist Bobby Campbell. What I kind of wanted to ask you if you remember the very early days of the epidemic.
Oh, right?
1981. Where were you living?
In 1981, I was just beginning graduate school. I went to graduate school in Chicago, so I remember reading the Tribune, you know, a little thing about this gay cancer.
Right.
Which turned out to be Kaposi sarcoma, and appearing in New York and on the West Coast. And the theories that were put forth long before there was any kind of scientific evidence whatsoever to establish an etiology of the disease or anything, were things like one doctor came out and said, well, gay men produce more sperm than straight men. How did you find that out?
After some empirical research.
What fantasy does that emerge from? You know, and things like paupers, you know. And the reaction was, in many quarters, that a version of safer sex, simply stop having sex. Well, we know how that works. But that persisted as safer sex campaigns came along, and Gay Men's Health Crisis to begin with, and then, you know, other venues as well, where there was this dividing line between safe sex and unsafe sex, and you more or less lived your life on one side or the other. But in practice, of course, most people, gay, straight, whatever, don't live like that, you know. You may conscientiously try to practice safer sex, yes, but people fall off the wagon and have a great time doing it. So in some quarters, you know, there's become a much more sophisticated approach to realize that safer sex is not itself a kind of quarantine space, that sex, in any sense of the term, is risky, not just for transmission of viruses, but for you're giving other people your body.
Viruses are like water. We need them to survive. Our bodies require them as willing participants in the bustling metropolis that is our microbiome. Yet, at the same time, viruses, invisible to the naked eye, have a terrible power to shape and reshape our world, like a glacier slowly eroding a mountain range into a river valley. Viruses make us as much as they can break us, and they were doing so long before we even discovered their existence.
The emergence of the virus that would come to be known as the human immunodeficiency virus spread the image of a gay person as a biological other, whose unique genetic material was solely prone to this new illness. Of course, this idea of uniquely gay cancer was debunked as doctors realized that other demographics were suffering from the very same illness, such as patients who had recently received blood transfusion, heroin users, and the children of infected parents. Yet for a brief moment in time, even gay men themselves began to think of their bodies as genetic aberrations. Perhaps it is logical that a virus could be confused for a cancer. Both maladies infer a kind of senseless subdivision ad nauseam, a kind of hyper-productivity creation for creation's sake that overtakes the body, ultimately leading to its death. The virus is that overabundance of life, a reckless fecundity that, unlike cancer, is transferable, moving seamlessly from host to host like a game of whisper down the lane.
Yeah, just I was wondering how you felt when you heard the term gay cancer for the first time in 1981 or 82.
Oh, gay cancer.
Mm-hmm. Before there was even a term such as HIV.
Right, right. Well, I mean, even at the time it was strange because at least for lay people like myself, how could cancer be contagious? Mm-hmm. I mean, I think all it meant was that, you know, they've seen these cases of a cancer that typically appear in older men of Mediterranean heritage, where it is relative benign. It doesn't kill. There are tumors, but they grow very slow. They're not aggressive. And yet all of a sudden, they're appearing in young men, very young men, and they are extremely aggressive cancers that metastasize very quickly. And they simply notice that all these guys were gay. And I think that's all I ever took it to mean. I mean, leaving quite apart the preachers who said God was pissed off and so on and so forth. But even after that, it was you know, something that was particularly attached to gayness.
Viruses are like water. Long before we even discovered their existence. The first virus was not studied in isolation until 1892 by the Russian scientist Dmitry Ivanovsky during a study of tobacco plant blight, which would come to be known as the tobacco mosaic virus, an infectious agent that could traverse a barrier through which bacteria specifically could not pass. But most importantly, viruses, particularly large-scale pandemic events such as the Spanish influenza crisis of 1918, the ongoing HIV calamity, alter the way in which we, as human beings, perceive ourselves, our bodies, and the invisible markers that separate us into categories. Viruses not only replicate their own genetic material, but in doing so replicate the power structures implicit in our human society. There's a formidable body of literature that centers around the epidemic as an existential event. Characters must decide how they're going to participate in the world around them in this extraordinary moment in which normative social relations are suspended.
The contagion, the pest, creates the occasion to examine the intricacies of one's own flesh and one's own identity. In Daniel Defoe's Journal of a Plague Year, published in 1722, the author describes the bubonic plague outbreak that devastated London in 1664, when Defoe was only 5 years old. Daniel Defoe's Journal of a Plague Year. In the account, the city of London is thrown into a state of turmoil. The ubiquitous presence of death dissolves the authority of social decorum and moral restraint. Quote, whole streets seemed to be desolated, doors were left open, windows stood shattering with the wind in empty houses for want of people to shut them. In a word, people began to give up themselves to their fears and to think that all regulations and methods were in vain, and that there was nothing to be hoped for but a universal desolation. The fear of death took away all bowels of love, all concern for one another. End quote. Although the text is mostly a work of fiction, Defoe's writing on the plague underlines an essential characteristic of the outbreak as a unique event. Unlike wars or natural catastrophes, where there is a sense of shared allegiance to a common cause, an outbreak of a lethal virus or disease shatters communal bonds and lays bare humanity's darkest impulses to survive their neighbors, their friends, and their loved ones. The outbreak creates a state of exception. Forbidden pleasures are allowed to run rampant in the city streets. The glue that holds together the various aspects of our identity and our social position dissolves. This is why the promise of imminent death evokes the hazy atmosphere of an orgy. The promise of death offers us, for the first and possibly only time, a life that could be lived fully without consequences. Yet viruses, contagious diseases, epidemic outbreaks, these things are not egalitarian by nature.
Viruses are not egalitarian by nature. They do not affect all demographic populations in quite the same way. While 6,000 Londoners died in the plague of 1664, these fatalities were not evenly spread across society. Most of these deaths disproportionately came from impoverished classes, those forced to live in congested and sanitary conditions where human waste entered the water supply. The wealthy and aristocratic classes were able to watch the ravages of the plague from a safe distance in their country homes, such as Prince Prospero's palace in Poe's Mask of the Red Death, which the author describes as an extensive and magnificent structure.
In his short story, Poe describes Prospero's palace as a gated stronghold. Quote, an extensive and magnificent structure, the creation of the prince's own eccentric yet august taste. A strong and lofty wall girdled it in. This wall had gates of iron. The courtiers, having entered, brought furnaces and massy hammers and welded the bolts. They resolved to leave means neither of ingress nor egress to the sudden impulses of despair or of frenzy from within. The abbey was amply provisioned. With such precautions, the courtiers might bid defiance to contagion. The external world could take care of itself. In the meantime, it was folly to grieve or to think. The prince had provided all the appliances of pleasure. There were buffoons, there were improvisatori, there were ballet dancers, there were musicians, there was beauty, there was wine. All these and security were within. Without was the Red Death. As Poe's tale illustrates, contagion does not respect the borders and boundaries drawn up by human law or class structure. The disease makes its way into the prince's masquerade, dressed in red, blood-stained robes. Poe's story describes the danger of creating a false sense of distance that comes about through the stigmatization of illness. Our collective fear of illness creates the illusion that this illness is something material, that can be avoided, like a bouncer at Burgein, keeping out all American tourists in pleated khakis. The ineffability of the virus as it flows from victim to victim is evoked in the last paragraph of Poe's story, in which the prince falls down dead. Party revelers try to reveal the identity of the red masquerading guest, only to find a hollow void. Thank you.
If we could only distance ourselves from the dead and dying, we would be saved. The barbarians could be held at the gate. This assumption is based on the miasma theory of infection, in which an illness is thought to have emanated from organic material in a state of heightened decay. This idea is ancient, originating in traditional Hellenistic medical literature, particularly in texts attributed to the physician Galen. The miasma theory would continue to dominate medical science until the discovery of microorganisms by Louis Pasteur in the late 19th century, which would give birth to the germ theory of epidemiology.
However, the infectious model of miasma, in which one can be infected by a disease through mere spatial proximity, has been difficult to dispel, as it provides simple solutions to overwhelmingly complex problems, something that has proven to be a difficult temptation to resist. During the mid-1980s, presidential candidate Lyndon LaRouche lobbied for a quarantine for all AIDS patients and requested mandatory screenings for teachers and other public servants. Unfortunately, this line of thought is still with us today, as we can see from public comments by Betty Price, a Georgia state representative at a public health committee meeting in 2017. Quote, "What are we legally able to do? I don't want to say the word quarantine, but I guess I just said it." End quote. The taboo of disease as something one can catch in the air has proven to be a difficult illusion to shake off.
There was a movement, if I'm right, or you can correct me, in the mid-80s with Lyndon LaRouche and also other congressmen of this idea of quarantining people with AIDS. Was that still prevalent in this time that you were writing?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And, you know, it's only in the past few years that the International AIDS big medical conference could be held in the United States because the United States would not admit anyone with AIDS. And finally, you know, a few years ago, that restriction was dropped so that the conference could be held in the United States, and so people with AIDS from abroad could attend.
Even just to visit?
Even just to visit,
really?
Yes. It still holds true in places like Japan.
Really?
Well, the Japanese case is different, I mean, because they think AIDS is all a matter of Southeast Asian and Filipina prostitutes. But the point is this notion that one can quarantine, that by building a wall, you are going to keep infection out.
Thank you.
The plague, the virus, the invisible contagion that makes its home imperceptibly under our skin and bones, imprints its composition into our bloodstream. These things are not merely medical phenomenons, but moments of possibility in which human behavior comes under the microscope. As we saw in Defoe's Journal of a Plague Year, the unrest and discord that surrounds infection is always a microcosm of our society's disordered state. Epidemics rob us of our pretenses, and most importantly, our presumed innocence. As evidenced by the etymological correspondence between the words influence and influenza, the plague, as Antonin Artaud argues, represents the unique and subtle pathology of inspiration. In this sense, the act of writing is itself a plague, a need for creation and replication, for proliferation, for accumulation. To influence through ineffable means of persuasion without sheer force or drop of blood. To return to the critical years of 1981 and 1982, we can see this intermingling of lurid fascination and repulsion with the first victims of the disease that would soon come to be referred to as AIDS, acquired immune deficiency syndrome. In Randy Schilt's journalistic expose on the first years of the epidemic entitled And the Band Played On, the myth of a patient zero is set in stone. A single individual was made responsible for spreading the virus to gay communities in New York, San Francisco, and Los Angeles. Gaetan Dugas, a Canadian airline steward, was the modern equivalent of a sailor with a lover in every port. As one of the first carriers of the disease to be made aware of his condition, and who was a frequent visitor to gay bathhouses, Dugas was a good candidate to take on such a role as the nexus of what would soon become a global pandemic.
I mean, just intellectually, it's so much easier to have a single cause. I think there's that sort of thing. If you can identify the guilty parties, if you can identify the people who are responsible, that absolves you of any implication in the spread, for example, of disease.
And is that maybe one of the most dangerous aspects of this virus in particular? It's the way in which so many metaphors and metaphors of behavior and stigma come out of it, that people are not, that it's hard to have a sort of clear-eyed view of the situation?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, people said things about, and still do, about HIV and AIDS that they wouldn't dream of saying about the flu. You know, you're not guilty of having the flu. It's not a moral failing. Mm-hmm. And there's still a lot of that discourse running around. Nor are there the fantasies about the sort of people who get AIDS. Gays and drug users and hemophiliacs and so on and so forth. You know, it's...
The judgment is already
you just
in the initial
never
stage.
Would have thought of that in the case of flu.
As William Haver argues, the virus itself is larger than its biological definition as a chain of nucleic acid molecules wrapped in a protein coat. The fear of viral infection and the attempt to either ignore its existence or stop it in its tracks creates a dangerous yet imaginary binary between those who believe themselves to be safe and those who are deemed at risk, and thereby dangerous to the well-being of the other half.
There's a marvelous line from Deborah Brithsman, who used to teach at Binghamton. She says, "The point is not that anyone can be a queer. The point is that something queer can happen to anyone." And that's what the AIDS pandemic, what a lot of folks during the AIDS pandemic had to learn or have yet to learn. There is no safe place. You cannot protect yourself from the world. You can, you know, take certain safeguards against certain aspects of the world, yeah, but there are no guarantees.
The physical signifiers of illness written on the skin of people suffering from AIDS represented to a generation of onlookers the dangers of infection. This consequent marginalization can be seen as a second layer of violence that extends past the initial infirmity, a victimization that turns human beings into passive objects, as a forced integration of otherness that simultaneously and systematically subsumes one's body into a totalized narrative, into a story that they alone cannot tell.
Ross Lipton sprach mit dem Literaturwissenschaftler William Haver über die symbolische Gewalt gegen Betroffene von HIV und AIDS in den 1980er Jahren bis heute. Ein letzter Hinweis dazu. Ein aktuelles Kunstwerk, das sich zur Aufgabe gemacht hat, ein neues Vokabular für das Sprechen und Nachdenken über HIV zu erschließen, ist Alien Sex Club. Die begehbare Installation des britischen Künstlers John Walter ist eine grell, neon, bunte Explosion an Eindrücken und Informationen. Sie ahmt die architektonische Form einer Cruising Maze nach, einer für Sexclubs und schwulen Saunen typischen Struktur. 2015 erstmals in London und Liverpool gezeigt, ist Alien Sex Club derzeit wieder in der Londoner Welcome Collections zu sehen. Aber dort hört der Club nicht auf. Auf der Webseite des Alien Sex Clubs hat Walter Forschungs- und Kunstprojekte zusammengetragen, die sich mit HIV beschäftigen. Zwischen grundlegenden Informationen und Artikel findet man Fotografien seiner Skulpturen, erfundene, riesige, aufblasbare Viren, Medikamente, zuckerähnlich aus Schaumstoff, einem überdimensionierten Alien Sex Club Tarot. www.aliensexclubineinemwort.com. Sowohl künstlerisch als auch forscherisch gibt es hier viel zu entdecken.
Thank you.
Das war Super Science Me, Wissenschaft und Fiktion auf Radio Orange 94.0, diesmal über den Virus. Nochmal ein herzliches Dankeschön an Ross Lipton, der sowohl mit seinen Gedanken als auch seiner Musik so großzügig war und sie dieser Episode geschenkt hat.
To help us tell this story, we had a lot of help this month from an international cast and crew of collaborators, such as Jim Kroll, whose voice you heard reading parts of the narration, Darian Scatton, who helped record the interview with William Haver, Ben Scher from Blight Records, who helped record the music you heard, and of course, Julia Grillmeyer for making all of this possible. The music was composed by me, Ross Lipton, and performed by a brilliant team of Washington, D.C.-based musicians, including David Klinger, Ben Scher, Hannah Burris, Madeline B. Mueller, and Mara Pond at Blight Studios. If you would like more information on Blight Records and their music, check out blightrecords.org or blightrecords.bandcamp.com.
Die kommende Ausgabe von Super Science Me wird am 8. Mai ausgestrahlt und, ja, es ist kein Scherz, es wird nochmal tentakulär. Im Laufe der Recherchen über die Quallen und Oktopusse der vergangenen zwei tentakulären Ausgaben hat sich so spannendes Material angesammelt, dass es nicht in der Schublade bleiben kann. Es wird Auszüge aus einem Vortrag über queere Quallen geben, sowie Berichte von Staatsquallengipfeln. Rise of the Slime. 8. Mai, Super Science Me auf Radio Orange 94.0. Alle Informationen zur Sendung sowie alle vorigen Ausgaben zum Nachhören findet ihr auf o94.at auf der Seite der Sendereihe Super Science Me. Für Updates folgt uns auf Facebook, Instagram oder Twitter. Julia Grillmeier sagt vielen Dank fürs Zuhören und bis bald bei Super Science Me.